to spend their own money to acquire the good, the choosers could receive either a mug or a sum of money, and they indicated the amount of money that was as desirable as receiving the good. These were the results. Sellers, $7.12. Choosers, $3.12. Buyers, $2.87. The gap between sellers and choosers is remarkable because they actually face the same choice. If you are a seller, you can go home with either a mug or money, and if you are a chooser, you have exactly the same two options. The long-term effects of the decision are identical for the two groups. The only difference is in the emotion of the moment. The high price that sellers set reflects the reluctance to give up an object that they already own, a reluctance that can be seen in babies who hold on fiercely to a toy and show great agitation when it is taken away. Loss aversion is built into the automatic evaluations of System 1. Buyers and choosers set similar cash values, although the buyers have to pay for the mug, which is free for the choosers. This is what we would expect if buyers do not experience spending money on the mug as a loss. Evidence from brain imaging confirms the difference. Selling goods that one would normally use activates regions of the brain that are associated with disgust and pain. Buying also activates these areas, but only when the prices are perceived as too high, when you feel that a seller is taking money that exceeds the exchange value. Brain recordings also indicate that buying at especially low prices is a pleasurable event. The cash value that the seller set on the mug is a bit more than twice as high as the value set by choosers and buyers. The ratio is very close to the loss aversion coefficient in risky choice, as we might expect if the same value function for gains and losses of money is applied to both riskless and risky decisions. A ratio of about 2-to-1 has appeared in studies of diverse economic domains, including the response of households to price changes. As economists would predict, customers tend to increase their purchases of eggs, orange juice, or fish when prices drop, and to reduce their purchases when prices rise. However, in contrast to the predictions of economic theory, the effect of price increases, losses relative to the reference price, is about twice as large as the effect of gains. The Muggs experiment has remained the standard demonstration of the endowment effect, along with an even simpler experiment that Jack Kanetch reported at about the same time. Kanetch asked two classes to fill out a questionnaire and rewarded them with a gift that remained in front of them for the duration of the experiment. In one session, the prize was an expensive pen, in another, a bar of Swiss chocolate. At the end of the class, the experimenter showed the alternative gift and allowed everyone to trade his or her gift for another. Only about 10% of the participants opted to exchange their gift. Most of those who had received the pen stayed with the pen, and those who had received the chocolate did not budge either. Thinking like a trader. The fundamental ideas of prospect theory are that reference points exist and that losses loom larger than corresponding gains. Observations in real markets collected over the years illustrate the power of these concepts. A study of the market for condo apartments in Boston during a downturn yielded particularly clear results. The authors of that study compared the behavior of owners of similar units who had bought their dwellings at different prices. For a rational agent, the buying price is irrelevant history. The current market value is all that matters. Not so for humans in a down market for housing. Owners who have a high reference point and thus face higher losses set a higher price on their dwelling, spend a longer time trying to sell their home, and eventually receive more money. The original demonstration of an asymmetry between selling prices and buying prices, or more convincingly between selling and choosing, was very important in the initial acceptance of the ideas of reference point and loss aversion. However, it is well understood that reference points are labile, especially in unusual laboratory situations, and that the endowment effect can be eliminated by changing the reference point. No endowment effect is expected when owners view their goods as carriers of value for future exchanges, a widespread attitude in routine commerce and in financial markets. The experimental economist John List, who has studied trading at baseball card conventions, found that novice traders were reluctant to part with cards they owned, but that this reluctance eventually disappeared with trading experience. More surprisingly, List found a large effect of trading experience on the endowment effect for new goods. At a convention, List displayed a notice that invited people to take part in a short survey, for which they would be compensated with a small gift, a coffee mug or a chocolate bar of equal value. Their gifts were assigned at random. As the volunteers were about to leave, List said to each of them, "We gave you a mug or chocolate bar, but you can trade for a chocolate bar or mug instead, if you wish." In an exact replication of Jack Canetch's earlier experiment, List found that only 18% of the inexperienced traders were willing to exchange their gift for another. In sharp contrast, experienced traders showed no trace of an endowment effect. 48% of them traded. At least in a market environment in which trading was the norm, they showed no reluctance to trade. Jack Canetch also conducted experiments in which subtle manipulations made the endowment effect disappear. Participants displayed an endowment effect only if they had physical possession of the good for a while before the possibility of trading it was mentioned. Economists of the standard persuasion might be tempted to say that Canetch had spent too much time with psychologists because his experimental manipulation showed concern for the variables that social psychologists expect to be important. Indeed, the different methodological concerns of experimental economists and psychologists have been much in evidence in the ongoing debate about the endowment effect. Veteran traders have apparently learned to ask the correct question, which is, how much do I want to have that mug, compared with other things I could have instead? This is the question that econs ask, and with this question, there is no endowment effect, because the asymmetry between the pleasure of getting and the pain of giving up is irrelevant. Recent research of the psychology of decision-making under poverty suggests that the poor are another group in which we do not expect to find the endowment effect. Being poor, in prospect theory, is living below one's reference point. There are goods that the poor need and cannot afford, so they are always in the losses. Small amounts of money that they receive are therefore perceived as a reduced loss, not as a gain. The money helps one climb a little toward the reference point, but the poor always remain on the steep limb of the value function. People who are poor think like traders, but the dynamics are quite different. Unlike traders, the poor are not indifferent to the differences between gaining and giving up. Their problem is that all their choices are between losses. Money that is spent on one good is the loss of another good that could have been purchased instead. For the poor, costs are losses. We all know people for whom spending is painful, although they are objectively quite well off. There may also be cultural differences in the attitude toward money, and especially to the spending of money on whims and minor luxuries, such as the purchase of a decorated mug. Such a difference may explain the large discrepancy between the results of the Mugs study in the United States and in the UK. Buying and selling prices diverge much more in experiments conducted in samples of students of the United States, but the differences are much smaller among English students. Much remains to be learned about the endowment effect. Speaking of the endowment effect. She didn't care which of the two offices she would get, but a day after the announcement was made, she was no longer willing to trade. Endowment effect. These negotiations are going nowhere because both sides find it difficult to make concessions, even when they can get something in return. Losses loom larger than gains. When they raised their prices, demand dried up. He just hates the idea of selling his house for less money than he paid for it. Loss aversion is at work. He is a miser and treats any dollar he spends as a loss. Chapter 28. Bad Events. The concept of loss aversion is certainly the most significant contribution of psychology to behavioral economics. This is odd, because the idea that people evaluate many outcomes as gains and losses, and that losses loom larger than gains, surprises no one. Amos and I often joked that we were engaged in studying a subject about which our grandmothers knew a great deal. In fact, however, we know more than our grandmothers did, and can now embed loss aversion in the context of a broader two-systems model of the mind, and specifically a biological and psychological view in which negativity and escape dominate positivity and approach. We can also trace the consequences of loss aversion in surprisingly diverse observations. Only out-of-pocket losses are compensated when goods are lost in transport. Attempts at large-scale reforms very often fail, and professional golfers putt more accurately for par than for birdie. Clever as she was, my grandmother would have been surprised by the specific predictions from a general idea she considered obvious. Negativity dominance. Take a look at figure 12 on the PDF. Your heartbeat accelerated when you looked at the left set of eyes. It accelerated even before you could label what is so eerie about that picture. After some time, you may have recognized the eyes of a terrified person. The eyes on the right, narrowed by the raised cheeks of a smile, express happiness, and they are not nearly as exciting. The two pictures were presented to people lying in a brain scanner. Each picture was shown for less than 2/100ths of a second and immediately masked by visual noise, a random display of dark and bright squares. None of the observers ever consciously knew that he had seen pictures of eyes, but one part of their brain evidently knew, the amygdala, which has a primary role as the threat center of the brain, although it is also activated in other emotional states. Images of the brain showed an intense response of the amygdala to a threatening picture that the viewers did not recognize. The information about the threat probably traveled via a superfast neural channel that feeds directly into a part of the brain that processes emotions, bypassing the visual cortex that supports the conscious experience of seeing. The same circuit also causes schematic angry faces, a potential threat, to be processed faster and more efficiently than schematic happy faces. Some experimenters have reported that an angry face pops out of a crowd of happy faces, but a single happy face does not stand out in an angry crowd. The brains of humans and other animals contain a mechanism that is designed to give priority to bad news. By shaving a few hundredths of a second from the time needed to detect a predator, this circuit improves the animal's odds of living long enough to reproduce. The automatic operations of System 1 reflect this evolutionary history. No comparably rapid mechanism for recognizing good news has been detected. Of course, we and our animal cousins are quickly alerted to signs of opportunities to mate or to feed, and advertisers design billboards accordingly. Still, threats are privileged above opportunities, as they should be. The brain responds quickly even to purely symbolic threats. Emotionally loaded words quickly attract attention, and bad words, war, crime, attract attention faster than do happy words, peace, love. There is no real threat, but the mere reminder of a bad event is treated in System 1 as threatening. As we saw earlier with the word vomit, the symbolic representation associatively evokes, in attenuated form, many of the reactions to the real thing, including physiological indices of emotion and even fractional tendencies to avoid or approach, recoil, or lean forward. The sensitivity to threats extends to the processing of statements of opinions with which we strongly disagree. For example, depending on your attitude to euthanasia, it would take your brain less than 1/4 of a second to register the threat in a sentence that starts with, "I think euthanasia is an acceptable/unacceptable." The psychologist Paul Rozin, an expert on disgust, observed that a single cockroach will completely wreck the appeal of a bowl of cherries, but a cherry will do nothing at all for a bowl of cockroaches. As he points out, the negative trumps the positive in many ways, and loss aversion is one of many manifestations of a broad negativity dominance. Other scholars, in a paper titled "Bad is Stronger Than Good," summarized the evidence as follows. Bad emotions, bad parents, and bad feedback have more impact than good ones, and bad information is processed more thoroughly than good. The self is more motivated to avoid bad self-definitions than to pursue good ones. Bad impressions and bad stereotypes are quicker to form and more resistant to disconfirmation than good ones. They cite John Gottman, the well-known expert in marital relations, who observed that the long-term success of a relationship depends far more on avoiding the negative than on seeking the positive. Gottman estimated that a stable relationship requires that good interactions outnumber bad interactions by at least 5-1. Other asymmetries in the social domain are even more striking. We all know that a friendship that may take years to develop can be ruined by a single action. Some distinctions between good and bad are hardwired into our biology. Infants enter the world ready to respond to pain as bad and to sweet, up to a point, as good. In many situations, however, the boundary between good and bad is a reference point that changes over time and depends on the immediate circumstances. Imagine that you are out in the country on a cold night, inadequately dressed for the torrential rain, your clothes soaked. A stinging cold wind completes your misery. As you wander around, you find a large rock that provides some shelter from the fury of the elements. The biologist, Michel Cabagnac, would call the experience of that moment intensely pleasurable because it functions, as pleasure normally does, to indicate the direction of a biologically significant improvement of circumstances. The pleasant relief will not last very long, of course, and you will soon be shivering behind the rock again, driven by your renewed suffering to seek better shelter. Goals are reference points. Loss aversion refers to the relative strength of two motives. We are driven more strongly to avoid losses than to achieve gains. A reference point is sometimes the status quo, but it can also be a goal in the future. Not achieving a goal is a loss. Exceeding the goal is a gain. As we might expect from negativity dominance, the two motives are not equally powerful. The aversion to the failure of not reaching the goal is much stronger than the desire to exceed it. People often adopt short-term goals that they strive to achieve, but not necessarily to exceed. They are likely to reduce their efforts when they have reached an immediate goal, with results that sometimes violate economic logic. New York cab drivers, for example, may have a target income for the month or the year, but the goal that controls their effort is typically a daily target of earnings. Of course, the daily goal is much easier to achieve and exceed on some days than on others. On rainy days, a New York cab never remains free for long, and the driver quickly achieves his target. Not so in pleasant weather, when cabs often waste time cruising the streets looking for fares. Economic logic implies that cab drivers should work many hours on rainy days and treat themselves to some leisure on mild days when they can buy leisure at a lower price. The logic of loss aversion suggests the opposite. Drivers who have a fixed daily target will work many more hours when the pickings are slim and go home early when rain-drenched customers are begging to be taken somewhere. The economists Devin Pope and Maurice Schweitzer at the University of Pennsylvania reasoned that golf provides a perfect example of a reference point. Par. Every hole on the golf course has a number of strokes associated with it. The par number provides the baseline for good, but not outstanding, performance. For a professional golfer, a birdie, one stroke under par, is a gain, and a bogey, one stroke over par, is a loss. The economists compared two situations a player might face when near the hole. Putt to avoid a bogey, putt to achieve a birdie. Every stroke counts in golf, and in professional golf, every stroke counts a lot. According to prospect theory, however, some strokes count more than others. Failing to make par is a loss, but missing a birdie putt is a foregone gain, not a loss. Pope and Schweitzer reasoned from loss aversion that players would try a little harder when putting for par to avoid a bogey than when putting for a birdie. They analyzed more than 2.5 million putts in exquisite detail to test that prediction. They were right. Whether the putt was easy or hard, at every distance from the hole, the players were more successful when putting for par than for a birdie. The difference in the rate of success when going for par, to avoid a bogey, or for a birdie, was 3.6%. This difference is not trivial. Tiger Woods was one of the participants in their study. If in his best years Tiger Woods had managed to putt as well for birdies as he did for par, his average tournament score would have improved by one stroke and his earnings by almost $1 million per season. These fierce competitors certainly do not make a conscious decision to slack off on birdie putts, but their intense aversion to a bogey apparently contributes to extra concentration on the task at hand. The study of putts illustrates the power of a theoretical concept as an aid to thinking. Who would have thought it worthwhile to spend months analyzing putts for par and birdie? The idea of loss aversion, which surprises no one except perhaps some economists, generated a precise and non-intuitive hypothesis and led researchers to a finding that surprised everyone, including professional golfers. Defending the status quo. If you are set to look for it, the asymmetric intensity of the motives to avoid losses and to achieve gains shows up almost everywhere. It is an ever-present feature of negotiations, especially of renegotiations of an existing contract, the typical situation in labor negotiations and in international discussions of trade or arms limitations. The existing terms define reference points, and a proposed change in any aspect of the agreement is inevitably viewed as a concession that one side makes to the other. Loss aversion creates an asymmetry that makes agreements difficult to reach. The concessions you make to me are my gains, but they are your losses. They cause you much more pain than they give me pleasure. Inevitably, you will place a higher value on them than I do. The same is true, of course, of the very painful concessions you demand from me, which you do not appear to value sufficiently. Negotiations over a shrinking pie are especially difficult, because they require an allocation of losses. People tend to be much more easygoing when they bargain over an expanding pie. Many of the messages that negotiators exchange in the course of bargaining are attempts to communicate a reference point and provide an anchor to the other side. The messages are not always sincere. Negotiators often pretend intense attachment to some good, perhaps missiles of a particular type in bargaining over arms reductions, although they actually view that good as a bargaining chip and intend ultimately to give it away in an exchange. Because negotiators are influenced by a norm of reciprocity, a concession that is presented as painful calls for an equally painful and perhaps equally inauthentic concession from the other side. Animals, including people, fight harder to prevent losses than to achieve gains. In the world of territorial animals, this principle explains the success of defenders. A biologist observed that when a territory holder is challenged by a rival, the owner almost always wins the contest, usually within a matter of seconds. In human affairs, the same simple rule explains much of what happens when institutions attempt to reform themselves in reorganizations and restructuring of companies, and in efforts to rationalize a bureaucracy, simplify the tax code, or reduce medical costs. As initially conceived, plans for reform almost always produce many winners and some losers while achieving an overall improvement. If the affected parties have any political influence, however, potential losers will be more active and determined than potential winners. The outcome will be biased in their favor and inevitably more expensive and less effective than initially planned. Reforms commonly include grandfather clauses that protect current stakeholders. For example, when the existing workforce is reduced by attrition rather than by dismissals, or when cuts in salaries and benefits apply only to future workers. Loss aversion is a powerful conservative force that favors minimal changes from the status quo in the lives of both institutions and individuals. This conservatism helps keep us stable in our neighborhood, our marriage, and our job. It is the gravitational force that holds our life together near the reference point. Loss aversion in the law. During the year that we spent working together in Vancouver, Richard Thaler, Jack Knetch, and I were drawn into a study of fairness in economic transactions, partly because we were interested in the topic, but also because we had an opportunity, as well as an obligation, to make up a new questionnaire every week. The Canadian government's Department of Fisheries and Oceans had a program for unemployed professionals in Toronto who were paid to administer telephone surveys. The large team of interviewers worked every night, and new questions were constantly needed to keep the operation going. Through Jack Knetch, we agreed to generate a questionnaire every week in four color-labeled versions. We could ask about anything. The only constraint was that the questionnaire should include at least one mention of fish to make it pertinent to the mission of the department. This went on for many months, and we treated ourselves to an orgy of data collection. We studied public perceptions of what constitutes unfair behavior on the part of merchants, employers, and landlords. Our overarching question was whether the opprobrium attached to unfairness imposes constraints on profit-seeking. We found that it does. We also found that the moral rules by which the public evaluates what firms may or may not do draw a crucial distinction between losses and gains. The basic principle is that the existing wage, price, or rent sets a reference point, which has the nature of an entitlement that must not be infringed. It is considered unfair for the firm to impose losses on its customers or workers relative to the reference transaction, unless it must do so to protect its own entitlement. Consider this example. A hardware store has been selling snow shovels for $15. The morning after a large snowstorm, the store raises the price to $20. Please rate this action as completely fair, acceptable, unfair, very unfair. The hardware store behaves appropriately according to the standard economic model. It responds to increased demand by raising its price. The participants in the survey did not agree. 82% rated the action unfair or very unfair. They evidently viewed the pre-blizzard price as a reference point and the raised price as a loss that the store imposes on its customers, not because it must, but simply because it can. A basic rule of fairness, we found, is that the exploitation of market power to impose losses on others is unacceptable. The following example illustrates this rule in another context. The dollar values should be adjusted for about 100% inflation since these data were collected in 1984. A small photocopying shop has one employee who has worked there for 6 months and earns $9 per hour. Business continues to be satisfactory, but a factory in the area has closed and unemployment has increased. Other small shops have now hired reliable workers at $7 an hour to perform jobs similar to those done by the photocopy shop employee. The owner of the shop reduces the employee's wage to $7. The respondents did not approve. 83% considered the behavior unfair or very unfair. However, a slight variation on the question clarifies the nature of the employer's obligation. The background scenario of a profitable store in an area of high unemployment is the same, but now the current employee leaves and the owner decides to pay a replacement $7 an hour. A large majority, 73%, considered this action acceptable. It appears that the employer does not have a moral obligation to pay $9 an hour. The entitlement is personal. The current worker has a right to retain his wage, even if market conditions would allow the employer to impose a wage cut. The replacement worker has no entitlement to the previous worker's reference wage, and the employer is therefore allowed to reduce pay without the risk of being branded unfair. The firm has its own entitlement, which is to retain its current profit. If it faces a threat of a loss, it is allowed to transfer the loss to others. A substantial majority of respondents believed that it is not unfair for a firm to reduce its workers' wages when its profitability is falling. We described the rules as defining dual entitlements to the firm and to individuals with whom it interacts. When threatened, it is not unfair for the firm to be selfish. It is not even expected to take on part of the losses. It can pass them on. Different rules governed what the firm could do to improve its profits or to avoid reduced profits. When a firm faced lower production costs, the rules of fairness did not require it to share the bonanza with either its customers or its workers. Of course, our respondents liked a firm better and described it as more fair if it was generous when its profits increased, but they did not brand as unfair a firm that did not share. They showed indignation only when a firm exploited its power to break informal contracts with workers or customers and to impose a loss on others in order to increase its profit. The important task for students of economic fairness is not to identify ideal behavior, but to find the line that separates acceptable conduct from actions that invite opprobrium and punishment. We were not optimistic when we submitted our report of this research to the American Economic Review. Our article challenged what was then accepted wisdom among many economists that economic behavior is ruled by self-interest and that concerns for fairness are generally irrelevant. We also relied on the evidence of survey responses, for which economists generally have little respect. However, the editor of the journal sent our article for evaluation to two economists who were not bound by those conventions. We later learned their identity. They were the most friendly the editor could have found. The editor made the correct call. The article is often cited, and its conclusions have stood the test of time. More recent research has supported the observations of reference-dependent fairness and has also shown that fairness concerns are economically significant, a fact we had suspected but did not prove. Employers who violate rules of fairness are punished by reduced productivity, and merchants who follow unfair pricing policies can expect to lose sales. People who learned from a new catalog that the merchant was now charging less for a product that they had recently bought at a higher price reduced their future purchases from that supplier by 15%, an average loss of $90 per customer. The customers evidently perceived the lower price as the reference point and thought of themselves as having sustained a loss by paying more than appropriate. Moreover, the customers who reacted the most strongly were those who bought more items and at higher prices. The losses far exceeded the gains from the increased purchases produced by the lower prices in the new catalog. Unfairly imposing losses on people can be risky if the victims are in a position to retaliate. Furthermore, experiments have shown that strangers who observe unfair behavior often join in the punishment. Neuroeconomists, scientists who combine economics with brain research, have used MRI machines to examine the brains of people who are engaged in punishing one stranger for behaving unfairly to another stranger. Remarkably, altruistic punishment is accompanied by increased activity in the pleasure centers of the brain. It appears that maintaining the social order and the rules of fairness in this fashion is its own reward. Altruistic punishment could well be the glue that holds societies together. Our brains are not designed to reward generosity as reliably as they punish meanness. Here again, we find a marked asymmetry between losses and gains. The influence of loss aversion and entitlements extends far beyond the realm of financial transactions. Jurists were quick to recognize their impact on the law and in the administration of justice. In one study, David Cohen and Jack Knetch found many examples of a sharp distinction between actual losses and foregone gains in legal decisions. For example, a merchant whose goods were lost in transit may be compensated for costs he actually incurred, but is unlikely to be compensated for lost profits. The familiar rule that possession is 9/10 of the law confirms the moral status of the reference point. In a more recent discussion, Eyal Zamir makes the provocative point that the distinction drawn in the law between restoring losses and compensating for foregone gains may be justified by their asymmetrical effects on individual well-being. If people who lose suffer more than people who merely fail to gain, they may also deserve more protection from the law. Speaking of losses, this reform will not pass. Those who stand to lose will fight harder than those who stand to gain. Each of them thinks the other's concessions are less painful. They're both wrong, of course. It's just the asymmetry of losses. They would find it easier to renegotiate the agreement if they realized the pie was actually expanding. They're not allocating losses, they're allocating gains. Rental prices around here have gone up recently, but our tenants don't think it's fair that we should raise their rent too. They feel entitled to their current terms. My clients don't resent the price hike because they know my costs have gone up too. They accept my right to stay profitable. Chapter 29. The Fourfold Pattern. Whenever you form a global evaluation of a complex object, a car you may buy, your son-in-law, or an uncertain situation, you assign weights to its characteristics. This is simply a cumbersome way of saying that some characteristics influence your assessment more than others do. The weighting occurs whether or not you are aware of it. It is an operation of System 1. Your overall evaluation of a car may put more or less weight on gas economy, comfort, or appearance. Your judgment of your son-in-law may depend more or less on how rich or handsome or reliable he is. Similarly, your assessment of an uncertain prospect assigns weights to the possible outcomes. The weights are certainly correlated with the probabilities of these outcomes. A 50% chance to win $1 million is much more attractive than a 1% chance to win the same amount. The assignment of weights is sometimes conscious and deliberate. Most often, however, you are just an observer to a global evaluation that your System 1 delivers. Changing chances. One reason for the popularity of the gambling metaphor in the study of decision-making is that it provides a natural rule for the assignment of weights to the outcomes of a prospect. The more probable an outcome, the more weight it should have. The expected value of a gamble is the average of its outcomes, each weighted by its probability. For example, the expected value of 20% chance to win $1,000 and 75% chance to win $100 is $275. In the pre-Bernoulli days, gambles were assessed by their expected value. Bernoulli retained this method for assigning weights to the outcomes, which is known as the expectation principle, but applied it to the psychological value of the outcomes. The utility of a gamble, in his theory, is the average of the utilities of its outcomes, each weighted by its probability. The expectation principle does not correctly describe how you think about the probabilities related to risky prospects. In the four examples below, your chances of receiving $1 million improve by 5%. Is the news equally good in each case? A. From 0 to 5%. B. From 5% to 10%. C. From 60% to 65%. D. From 95% to 100%. The expectation principle asserts that your utility increases in each case by exactly 5% of the utility of receiving $1 million. Does this prediction describe your experiences? Of course not. Everyone agrees that 0 to 5% and 95% to 100% are more impressive than either 5% to 10% or 60% to 65%. Increasing the chances from 0 to 5% transforms the situation, creating a possibility that did not exist earlier, a hope of winning the prize. It is a qualitative change, where 5 to 10% is only a quantitative improvement. The change from 5% to 10% doubles the probability of winning, but there is general agreement that the psychological value of the prospect does not double. The large impact of 0 to 5% illustrates the possibility effect, which causes highly unlikely outcomes to be weighted disproportionately more than they deserve. People who buy lottery tickets in vast amounts show themselves willing to pay much more than expected value for very small chances to win a large prize. The improvement from 95% to 100% is another qualitative change that has a large impact, the certainty effect. Outcomes that are almost certain are given less weight than their probability justifies. To appreciate the certainty effect, imagine that you inherited $1 million, but your greedy stepsister has contested the will in court. The decision is expected tomorrow. Your lawyer assures you that you have a strong case and that you have a 95% chance to win, but he takes pains to remind you that judicial decisions are never perfectly predictable. Now you are approached by a risk adjustment company which offers to buy your case for $910,000 outright, take it or leave it. The offer is lower, by $40,000, than the expected value of waiting for the judgment, which is $950,000. But are you quite sure you would want to reject it? If such an event actually happens in your life, you should know that a large industry of structured settlements exists to provide certainty at a hefty price by taking advantage of the certainty effect. Possibility and certainty have similarly powerful effects in the domain of losses. When a loved one is wheeled into surgery, a 5% risk that an amputation will be necessary is very bad, much more than half as bad as a 10% risk. Because of the possibility effect, we tend to overweight small risks and are willing to pay far more than expected value to eliminate them altogether. The psychological difference between a 95% risk of disaster and the certainty of disaster appears to be even greater. The sliver of hope that everything could still be okay looms very large. Overweighting of small probabilities increases the attractiveness of both gambles and insurance policies. The conclusion is straightforward. The decision weights that people assign to outcomes are not identical to the probabilities of these outcomes, contrary to the expectation principle. Improbable outcomes are overweighted. This is the possibility effect. Outcomes that are almost certain are underweighted relative to actual certainty. The expectation principle, by which values are weighted by their probability, is poor psychology. The plot thickens, however, because there is a powerful argument that a decision maker who wishes to be rational must conform to the expectation principle. This was the main point of the axiomatic version of utility theory that von Neumann and Morgenstern introduced in 1944. They proved that any weighting of uncertain outcomes that is not strictly proportional to probability leads to inconsistencies and other disasters. Their derivation of the expectation principle from axioms of rational choice was immediately recognized as a monumental achievement, which placed expected utility theory at the core of the rational agent model in economics and other social sciences. 30 years later, when Amos introduced me to their work, he presented it as an object of awe. He also introduced me to a famous challenge to that theory. Allais' paradox. In 1952, a few years after the publication of von Neumann and Morgenstern's theory, a meeting was convened in Paris to discuss the economics of risk. Many of the most renowned economists of the time were in attendance. The American guests included the future Nobel laureates Paul Samuelson, Kenneth Arrow, and Milton Friedman, as well as the leading statistician, Jimmy Savage. One of the organizers of the Paris meeting was Maurice Allais, who would also receive a Nobel Prize some years later. Allais had something up his sleeve, a couple of questions on choice that he presented to his distinguished audience. In the terms of this chapter, Allais intended to show that his guests were susceptible to a certainty effect and therefore violated expected utility theory and the axioms of rational choice on which that theory rests. The following set of choices is a simplified version of the puzzle that Allais constructed. Which option would you choose in each of the following problems? A. 61% chance to win $520,000 or 63% chance to win $500,000. B. 98% chance to win $520,000 or 100% chance to win $500,000. If you are like most other people, you preferred the left-hand option in problem A and you preferred the right-hand option in problem B. If these were your preferences, you have just committed a logical sin and violated the rules of rational choice. The illustrious economists assembled in Paris committed similar sins in a more involved version of the Allais paradox. To see why these choices are problematic, imagine that the outcome will be determined by a blind draw from an urn that contains 100 marbles. You win if you draw a red marble, you lose if you draw white. In problem A, almost everybody prefers the left-hand urn, although it has fewer winning red marbles, because the difference in the size of the prize is more impressive than the difference in the chances of winning. In problem B, a large majority chooses the urn that guarantees a gain of $500,000. Furthermore, people are comfortable with both choices, until they are led through the logic of the problem. Compare the two problems, and you will see that the two urns of problem B are more favorable versions of the urns of problem A, with 37 white marbles replaced by red winning marbles in each urn. The improvement on the left is clearly superior to the improvement on the right, since each red marble gives you a chance to win $520,000 on the left and only $500,000 on the right. So you started in the first problem with a preference for the left-hand urn, which was then improved more than the right-hand urn, but now you like the one on the right. This pattern of choices does not make logical sense, but a psychological explanation is readily available. The certainty effect is at work. The 2% difference between a 100% and a 98% chance to win in problem B is vastly more impressive than the same difference between 63% and 61% in problem A. As Allais had anticipated, the sophisticated participants at the meeting did not notice that their preferences violated utility theory until he drew their attention to that fact as the meeting was about to end. Allais had intended this announcement to be a bombshell. The leading decision theorists in the world had preferences that were inconsistent with their own view of rationality. He apparently believed that his audience would be persuaded to give up the approach that he rather contemptuously labeled the American school and adopt an alternative logic of choice that he had developed. He was to be sorely disappointed. Economists who were not aficionados of decision theory mostly ignored the Allais problem. As often happens when a theory that has been widely adopted and found useful is challenged, they noted the problem as an anomaly and continued using expected utility theory as if nothing had happened. In contrast, decision theorists, a mixed collection of statisticians, economists, philosophers, and psychologists, took Allais's challenge very seriously. When Amos and I began our work, one of our initial goals was to develop a satisfactory psychological account of Allais' paradox. Most decision theorists, notably including Allais, maintained their belief in human rationality and tried to bend the rules of rational choice to make the Allais pattern permissible. Over the years, there have been multiple attempts to find a plausible justification for the certainty effect, none very convincing. Amos had little patience for these efforts. He called the theorists who tried to rationalize violations of utility theory lawyers for the misguided. We went in another direction. We retained utility theory as a logic of rational choice, but abandoned the idea that people are perfectly rational choosers. We took on the task of developing a psychological theory that would describe the choices people make, regardless of whether they are rational. In prospect theory, decision weights would not be identical to probabilities. Decision weights. Many years after we published prospect theory, Amos and I carried out a study in which we measured the decision weights that explained people's preferences for gambles with modest monetary stakes. The estimates for gains are probability percent 0, decision weight 0, probability percent 1, decision weight 5.5, probability percent 2, decision weight 8.1, probability percent 5, decision weight 13.2, probability percent 10, decision weight 18.6, probability percent 20, decision weight 26.1, probability percent 50, decision weight 42.1, probability percent 80, decision weight 60.1, probability percent 90, decision weight 71.2, probability percent 95, decision weight 79.3, probability percent 98, decision weight 87.1, probability percent 99, decision weight 91.2, probability percent 100, decision weight 100. You can see that the decision weights are identical to the corresponding probabilities at the extremes, both equal to 0 when the outcome is impossible, and both equal to 100 when the outcome is a sure thing. However, decision weights depart sharply from probabilities near these points. At the low end, we find the possibility effect. Unlikely events are considerably overweighted. For example, the decision weight that corresponds to a 2% chance is 8.1. If people conformed to the axioms of rational choice, the decision weight would be 2. So the rare event is overweighted by a factor of 4. The certainty effect at the other end of the probability scale is even more striking. A 2% risk of not winning the prize reduces the utility of the gamble by 13%, from 100 to 87.1. To appreciate the asymmetry between the possibility effect and the certainty effect, imagine first that you have a 1% chance to win $1 million. You will know the outcome tomorrow. Now, imagine that you are almost certain to win $1 million, but there is a 1% chance that you will not. Again, you will learn the outcome tomorrow. The anxiety of the second situation appears to be more salient than the hope in the first. The certainty effect is also more striking than the possibility effect if the outcome is a surgical disaster rather than a financial gain. Compare the intensity with which you focus on the faint sliver of hope in an operation that is almost certain to be fatal, compared to the fear of a 1% risk. The combination of the certainty effect and possibility effects at the two ends of the probability scale is inevitably accompanied by inadequate sensitivity to intermediate probabilities. You can see that the range of probabilities between 5% and 95% is associated with a much smaller range of decision weights, from 13.2 to 79.3, about two-thirds as much as rationally expected. Neuroscientists have confirmed these observations, finding regions of the brain that respond to changes in the probability of winning a prize. The brain's response to variations of probabilities is strikingly similar to the decision weights estimated from choices. Probabilities that are extremely low or high below 1% or above 99% are a special case. It is difficult to assign a unique decision weight to very rare events, because they are sometimes ignored altogether, effectively assigned a decision weight of zero. On the other hand, when you do not ignore the very rare events,